It's Monday, September 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Pope Francis visits Cuba as Washington awaits his arrival.
I mean, we're a country who was built on refugees and people who are from other countries. And yeah, for us not to welcome people in when that's predominantly the background of everybody who lives there is just abominable.
Australia under pressure to accept more refugees. Also ahead, could robots be taking more of our jobs? And the work of a prominent Chinese artist goes on display in London. It's all on today's International Edition. Pope Francis celebrated Sunday Mass in Havana, warning Cubans of the dangers of ideology. Francis preached before tens of thousands of worshippers who packed Havana's historic Revolutionary Square. Francis also paid a visit to former Cuban leader Fidel Castro at his home in Havana. Francis and Vatican officials were the force behind months of secret talks in 2014, which reestablished diplomatic ties between Havana and Washington for the first time in 53 years. They have since opened embassies in Washington and Havana. The Pope will be visiting Washington this week, and joining me in the studio with more is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman.
Now, Jim, Washington is absolutely abuzz with the visit of Pope Francis this week. The city will grind to a halt. You cannot come into the city without seeing large signs warning you of absolute traffic pandemonium.
Right.
The city will essentially be shut down for a couple of days, and Congress will get absolutely nothing done. And this comes at a peculiar time, because at midnight on September 30th, the federal government spending authority expires. This week will be consumed with a papal visit. That means that there will be 1 week thereafter to overcome all the partisan issues, and there are many, and they are quite heartfelt when it comes to not passing a budget, which was done earlier, but passing the spending authority that flows from that budget. Mm-hmm.
One thing Congress will achieve this week is actually being able to see the Pope in person, because he will be speaking to Congress, which should be an interesting message.
Indeed, indeed. And it's interesting when you note the different takes on the papal visit from various members of Congress, many of whom are Catholic, but according to their party affiliation. One of the issues that's before Congress right now focuses squarely on abortion, which is something that the Catholic Church has taken a very firm stance against for a very long time. It turns out that a few months ago, there was a secretly recorded video of top officials of America's leading abortion provider called Planned Parenthood, in which top officials discussed the sale of body parts from fetuses that came from abortions. And this created a huge firestorm. Planned Parenthood pointed out that the videos were heavily edited, that they broke no laws. Nevertheless, this really brought the issue to the forefront of the Republican-led Congress. Mm-hmm. And there are many social conservatives among the Republican ranks. They control Congress. And what just happened on Friday is the House of Representatives passed a spending authorization for the entire year, minus the funds for Planned Parenthood. And this creates a problem, because in the Senate, even though there's a Republican majority leader of the Senate, he says that they don't have the votes to pass that very same bill in the Senate. And even if it were to pass in the Senate, you have President Obama who says he would veto it. And the votes do not exist to override the veto. So you have a real conflict here. Setting aside all the different spending priorities between Republicans and Democrats, Republicans typically want to spend more on the military side of things. Democrats typically want to spend more on the domestic welfare side of things. Setting all of that aside, you have this real confrontation on the issue of Planned Parenthood, and it's hard to see how it gets resolved. I mean, I wish I had, you know, I come to the microphone here feeling that I should be some wise sage and tell you, Jim, exactly how this is going to play out. But I have no idea how this plays out, because this goes to the core beliefs.
Right.
Of members of Congress, and it's hard to see how either side really compromises on this.
Right. And with such a small time for them to come to any sort of agreement in terms of the federal budget and whether or not this is going to be an issue that's actually going to force a shutdown of the government, and having the Pope come just the week before and no doubt talking about abortion, this could be quite an interesting period of time for lawmakers.
Indeed, it could. The one possibility here is that they pass some short-term stopgap measure that funds the government for a week, for 2 weeks, maybe even a month, to give them some more time to talk and bicker and twist arms and do everything that happens on Capitol Hill.
And come to another deadline.
And come to another deadline, much like this one. That is one possible way that at least the crisis could be averted in the short term. But the underlying issue, at some point, something will have to give. And it's not clear at this point which party would blink when that final deadline arrives, whether it's September 30th or a month later.
We're always glad to have Michael Bowman stop by our studios. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, it's time now to check out reactions on Twitter about the Pope's visit to Cuba. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in Studio 22 to tell us about the social media reaction. Welcome, G.
Hi, Jim. Let me begin with what Pope Francis himself tweeted about his visit to Cuba and the U.S. this month. Here is his latest tweet. I ask you to join me in praying for my trip to Cuba and the United States. I need your prayers. That tweet has been retweeted more than 11,000 times and marked as a favorite almost 30,000 times.
Wow. Well, gee, what are some of the hashtags related to the Pope's visit?
More than 6,000 tweets use the hashtag Pope Francis in the last 24 hours. A more specific hashtag, hashtag Pope in Cuba, was used in 3,000 tweets, and hashtag Pope in U.S. was used in 2,400 tweets in the last 24 hours. I think that's a pretty high number, given that he's not even here yet. And using the hashtag Pope in Cuba, I found John Williams' account, who is a managing editor for international affairs at ABC News. He's on Twitter at WilliamsJohn.
What did he tweet?
He was tweeting a lot about the Pope's visit Sunday, but one tweet that got a lot of attention is about how the Pope got out of his car to join the crowd, as he often does on his way to delivering Mass at the Revolution Square in Havana. He included a picture of Pope Francis getting out of the car and hashtag Pope in Cuba. Another tweet reads like this: Two revolutionaries together, Francis meets Fidel. Photo taken by hashtag Castro's son, Alex. Hashtag Pope in Cuba, hashtag Pope. In that photo, the former prime minister of Cuba, Fidel Castro, is wearing a blue sports jacket, and the Pope is dressed in his white gown. Jim?
Well, the Pope may be coming to Washington later this week, but we're always happy to have G. Abby Lee come to our studio each and every day. Follow her on Twitter, at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the Obama administration will increase the number of refugees allowed to enter the United States to 100,000 annually in 2017. This as Europe grapples with its largest influx of migrants since the end of World War II. Under the new plan, the U.S. limit on refugee visas, which is currently capped at 70,000 annually, would jump to 85,000 in fiscal 2016 and then rise to 100,000 the following year. Meanwhile, Australia is under pressure by rights groups to resettle more Syrian refugees. One of the last acts of ousted Prime Minister Tony Abbott was to announce plans to grant asylum to 12,000 members of persecuted minorities. It seems that the new man at the top, Malcolm Turnbull, will be unwilling to offer sanctuary to more refugees. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In the centre of Australia's biggest city, protesters Saturday had a clear message for the government: do much more to help those fleeing the conflict in Syria. The first of 12,000 Syrians should be in Australia by Christmas. But activists believe the wealthy multicultural nation should be willing to offer a haven to more refugees.
I mean, we're a country who was built on refugees and people who are from other countries. And yeah, for us not to welcome people in when that's predominantly the background of everybody who lives there is just abominable.
Pro and anti-refugee campaigners have clashed in recent weeks in Australia. In certain quarters, there's vehement opposition to Middle Eastern asylum seekers. So, will there be any major changes under new Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to a hardline stance on immigration, where the military turns migrant boats away from Australia, or where detainees are sent for processing in remote camps in the South Pacific? Experts say major policy changes are not likely, after Turnbull had earlier praised his predecessor's efforts to stop asylum seekers breaching the nation's maritime frontiers.
Restoring the security on our borders has been an extraordinarily important step, enabling us, for example, to offer the increased and generous arrangements for Syrian refugees last week.
Immigration remains one of Australia's most divisive issues, and Malcolm Turnbull, who's known for his progressive views, will be well aware that tough asylum policies helped the Conservatives to a landslide win at the last election in 2013. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Robots have replaced many humans in manufacturing jobs, and now other industries and professions may be taking over in part by robots, leaving humans without those jobs. VOA's Jeffrey Young asked Michael Osborne, an associate professor and researcher at Oxford University's Martin School, about his recent study that identifies career fields susceptible to robotic automation.
The outcome of our study was this finding that about 47% of current U.S. employment is at high risk of automation over the next 20 years.
What are the kind of jobs that could be automated and take humans out of the picture?
Due to advances in machine learning and mobile robotics is that it's not just kind of routine manual labor that's under threat, but increasingly cognitive labor. So what that means is that jobs like insurance appraisers, tax preparers, and even a lot of sales jobs are increasingly under threat.
I was reading in one publication that one aspect of automation that could be possible would be taxi drivers. Now that we have self-driving cars, just get in the cab and speak your destination and this automated car takes you there. Really?
There has been remarkable progress in autonomous vehicles or self-driving cars, but I think what we'll see first is the automation of driving tasks that are relatively structured. So what that means is we're probably likely to see the automation of forklift drivers, people who drive agricultural vehicles or mining vehicles before we see taxi drivers automated away.
Now, you were talking about tax preparers and other white-collar workers. They could be doing the job instead of human beings?
That's right. So, I mean, obviously, algorithms are increasingly adept at not just storing information, but accessing it rapidly and even doing relatively subtle processing of that data. So it turns out a lot of traditionally white-collar jobs really just revolve around those sort of tasks. So we've already seen the automation of people like paralegal occupations, a bunch of other clerical occupations, and I mentioned before retail operations where the recommendation of products to customers can perhaps be better performed by an algorithm.
One thing that I was thinking about is the difference between a robot and a human being is that human beings can nuance in so many different layers. Is robotics capable of nuancing?
Where we've made progress in kind of bringing automation to even nuanced tasks is with the gathering of sufficiently large data sets. So to take one example, consider machine translation, which is the automated translation of written text from one language to another. So So that's very much a task which you might have thought would require a lot of nuance, a lot of subtle understanding of cultural context. So the canonical example is that of the UN, which is required to translate its documents into 6 different constituent languages, perform translation by, first of all, identifying a small phrase that they want to translate, finding in that corpus of documents, and then they can make use of those 5 immediate translations into different languages.
Well, journalists being journalists wanted to know if robots were going to take over our jobs. Apparently, the likelihood is quite low at this point. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
A career retrospective of dissident Chinese artist Ai Weiwei has just opened at London's Royal Academy of Arts this month. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the exhibit features some of Ai's political and satirical works during the last 20 years.
Ai Weiwei is known for using his art to address political and human rights abuses, corruption, and the clash of Eastern and Western cultures. But the artist almost didn't get to come to his own exhibit because of a diplomatic snafu. In July, Chinese officials returned Ai's passport after 4 years, allowing him to travel. An outspoken critic of the Beijing government, Ai was detained without charge for 3 months in 2011. After his release, he was charged with tax evasion and fined $2.4 million. He appealed the fine, but his appeal was rejected, even though he had deposited more than $1.3 million as collateral. The artist later said he would not pay the rest because he did not recognize the charge. But as part of his bail, he could not travel. Ai's trip to London hit a further snag when the British Embassy in Beijing turned down his request for a 6-month business visa because he had not disclosed a criminal conviction. After a media uproar, British Home Secretary Theresa May overturned the embassy's move, and Ai was able to travel. Exhibition co-curator Tim Marlowe, the artistic director at the Royal Academy of Arts, says the situation made for some interesting workarounds as they prepared this exhibit.
He didn't have a passport till 4 weeks ago, and we made 8 visits between us to see him in Beijing. We communicate by email and phone as well. But he came for the just under the last third of the installation period, just over a week, and made very tiny tweaks.
The artist says that being in London, which he calls one of his favorite cities in the world, allows him to feel free to express himself in a way that he could not at home.
It's so comfortable. You can breathe the fresh air and to see the light or the wind of London. I mean, this is certainly it's so important. It's like if you ask a sportsman how those important to their actually running. The temperature, the air, everything works in and how it works in artist's work. What only can tell from the work, so I can't. For me, it's really a thrill.
This exhibit features one of the largest pieces ever mounted at the Royal Academy. The piece, called Straight, features more than 90 tons of undulating steel rods from buildings damaged in the 2008 Sichuan earthquake. I took them to his studio in Beijing, straightened them by hand, and returned them to the form they had before the earthquake. The names of thousands of earthquake victims are etched on the walls of the exhibit space. Another piece, Remains, is porcelain reproductions of human bone fragments from an inmate who died in a Chinese forced labor camp. The exhibition also features a pair of jade handcuffs, a 2,000-year-old vase painted with the Coca-Cola logo, and a surveillance camera carved from white marble from the same quarry that supplied the material for Chairman Mao's mausoleum. One room also contains recreations of Ai's house arrest, complete with models of the artist and his two guards, who stood only 30 centimeters away as he ate, slept, read, showered, and used the toilet. Ai says that he knows there will be a political impact from this show.
I never really separate my artwork with the political impact. I think all the questions in relating to political situation is integrated with my effort. And so it must be, if there's any impact, there's always a political impact.
Co-curator Tim Marlow says the exhibit, the largest British retrospective of Ai's work ever, marks a turning point in the artist's career.
I'd imagine that this is the next stage of his career just beginning. I wouldn't claim that this exhibition will take his career to the next level. I think whatever level he's got to go to, he's pretty close to anyway.
Ai Weiwei at the Royal Academy of Arts runs through December 13th, 2015. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can always find us at our website. That would be voanews.com. We're on Twitter as well at voa_IE. We hope you follow us. And we thank you for joining us, along with big thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We wish you a pleasant day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In its ongoing effort to combat illicit drugs, every year the United States prepares a list identifying nations playing a role in the international drug trade that significantly affect our country. Countries found to have failed to live up to international counter-narcotics agreements or other anti-drug programs can face cuts in American aid. Though the president has the authority to waive penalties in order to continue cooperation in these efforts, 22 nations are identified in the latest list of major drug-producing and transit countries. Ranging from Laos to Afghanistan to Haiti and Colombia, the countries may be listed because of a combination of geographic, commercial, and economic factors that allow illicit drugs to be produced in or shipped through them, despite their government's drug enforcement efforts. Burma is one of three nations, however, that have demonstrably failed to live up to their international counter-narcotics agreements or cooperate with the U.S. in its fight against illicit drug trafficking. Despite these shortcomings, Burma will not face sanctions, as the United States has decided to issue Burma a waiver to permit support for programs in the national interest of the United States, such as democratization and human rights. In addition to the country's illegal opium cultivation problem, Burma is the largest source of methamphetamine. Much of it is exported to Thailand. It has a devastating impact on drug users, and this substance is having an increasingly negative impact on China and the countries of Southeast Asia. Burma itself suffers from a high rate of illegal drug use, one of the worst in Asia. The United States has noted steps the Burmese government has taken to curb the narcotics trade. Opium production has declined in parts of the country, and law enforcement has seized some major drug caches. Closer cooperation in fighting this problem would be in the best interest of both nations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.